Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened this week. The CDC on Thursday afternoon issued new guidance regarding mask wearing in businesses. The organization's latest announcement reveals that Americans are no longer advised to wear masks either indoors or outdoors, save for a handful of instances, including in healthcare settings, at businesses that require them, or on airliners. The CDC also announced that the 6-foot social distancing guideline is no longer necessary for fully vaccinated Americans. President Biden quickly followed this announcement up with a tweet saying, quote, "The rule is now simple. Get vaccinated or wear a mask until you do. The choice is yours," end quote. Of course, this statement, in my opinion, only encouraged the discrimination already happening in many places across the country, my state of South Carolina being one, which leads me to my next story in the fallout. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has now provided a blueprint for how to actually enforce the termination of the mask mandate on local school districts. This past Tuesday, Governor McMaster ordered the state's Department of Health and Environmental Control and the state's Department of Education to distribute waiver forms to all parents, which will allow them to opt out of any mask mandate in their district's public school. This will ensure that any children will be allowed in school without their face covered if their parent signs the document. We have known for months that our schools are some of the safest places when it comes to COVID-19, McMaster said in a press release. With every adult in our state having the opportunity to receive a vaccine, it goes against all logic to continue to force our children, especially our youngest children, to wear masks against their parents' wishes. When a child wears a mask in school is a decision that should be left only to a student's parents. Notice that school districts are asserting that Biden's executive order still requires masking on buses. There's no reason there should not be a lawsuit in every school district on the grounds that the president not only violated the civil rights of children, but also overstepped his authority because these buses do not cross state lines. McMaster's executive order 2021-23 also declares any local mask mandate based on original emergency orders to be preempted and invalid. The order further prohibits any local government entity from requiring proof of vaccination to obtain services. It has become clear, in my opinion, that we'll have to pry the mask obsession out of these local governments with as much force as we can apply. We cannot rely on simply terminating mandates in word only, but must repeal them with as much force as they were implemented. Requiring school districts to mail out consent forms is a really good first step, in my opinion, which will also create a clear legal cause of action against those districts that violate the policy. Here in South Carolina, it was almost immediate. The sigh of relief from parents, the fact that, hey, they were ready and willing. All of the parents within my circle were ready and willing to sign this paper and be able to move past it. Some teachers and administrators here in South Carolina were willing to follow the executive order promptly. There was multiple school districts that were, as soon as that executive order came down on Wednesday, kids were able to go mask-free. There were other school districts, Greenville County being one, that said, well, wait a minute, you've got to have the opt-out paper. The DHEC hasn't, or the Department of Education hasn't sent it out, and you need to send that in, that you've got to have that signed. And, you know, they wanted to be and have all of the things, and they really drug their feet and kind of created issues for parents. But eventually, you know, the Department of Education had gotten the waiver out to parents pretty promptly, and parents were able to sign it and send their kids by Thursday with the waiver. And the very first day, unmasked students in some of these schools where they were really dragging their feet, some of the schools handed out red stickers for the students who didn't wear masks. They had to place it on their ID. Others teachers segregated unmasked students from the rest of the class. And some teachers even refused to allow students to leave their seats while in class to retrieve needed items or throw things away. And come on, though, with a president tweeting out such threatening statements as get a vaccine or wear a mask until you do, it's not a surprise that teachers and administrators felt free to treat some students like second-class citizens. The uproar, though, was pretty swift here in South Carolina, but what happens remains to be seen. With some of these teachers and administrators, like I said, the waiver came pretty quickly. The actual school districts, I think for the most part, I mean, it's, you know, we've only had a couple of days here, so we'll have to see. But the school districts seemed to fall in line once the waiver was released, for the most part. but it remains to be seen, in my opinion, what the long term, of course, we've only got 3.5 weeks of school left. So there's not a whole lot of time, but I know there was a lot of parents who, in my opinion, were very reasonable about wanting to get this ended now, because they knew if it didn't stop now, they were already talking about having masks, social distancing, and all of it next semester in the fall. And so they realized we've got to get this done now before that even becomes a discussion. So the thing, though, that really incensed me about this is that these kids have no control over this. Majority of these kids, I know that some of the parents that I saw, you know, if they had an older student, they would ask them, they say, hey, you know, if you're high school, you make the decision. If you want to wear a mask, you wear a mask. If you don't want to wear a mask, you don't have to wear a mask. I'll sign the waiver. There was multiple parents that had younger children, even elementary age children, and they, you know, they made sure that their student was comfortable not wearing a mask if they didn't want to wear a mask. And from what I could pick up from the parents that I knew, the overwhelming majority of students were ready to get rid of the masks. They were done. They're done with it. They're past it. They're over it. And so they were, but parents, I think very wisely, the ones that I know, consulted with their children and didn't force anything on them one way or the other. But what really, like I said, what really incensed me was that for the most part, though, these kids, they don't have a choice in all of this. They're just doing what the authorities, what the parents, guardians in their lives are telling them to do. Their parents are the ones making these decisions by and large. Yet these teachers and administrators are taking their frustrations and their anger out on the children and on the students. That's bullying and that's discrimination. And it's unfairly targeted children this week. Personally, if they want to discriminate, they should discriminate and bully the parents, but leave the children out of it. Moving on, let's go to the southern border. Border apprehensions during the month of April reached a new 20-year record, breaking the previous record set in March. Customs and Border Patrol Chief Troy Miller made the statement that CBP continues to see a large influx of illegal migration along the southwest border. How many migrants came in April? CBP agents encountered 178,622 migrants attempting to enter the U.S. via the southern border last month, which was a 3% increase over March. The number is more than 10 times higher, greater than April 2020, when 17,106 migrants were caught at the southern border. In fact, border apprehensions during President Joe Biden's first 3 full months in office, February, March, and April, now exceed all total apprehensions during fiscal year 2020, which was the last complete fiscal year prior to Biden's presidency. According to CBP data, single adults constituted the majority of all migrant encounters last month. Meanwhile, CBP deported more than 111,000 adults back to Mexico under the Title 42 public health order. CBP said 62.5% of all adult encounters resulted in a Title 42 deportation. So what about unaccompanied minors? That's what a lot of the conversation involves and kind of centers around. So fortunately, encounters of unaccompanied minors dropped 12% last month from 15,918 in March to 13,962. The CBP celebrated the fact that most unaccompanied minors who crossed the border are no longer in CBP custody, saying only 455 minors remained in the agency's care as of Tuesday. However, that statistic may be misleading because while the number of children in CBP custody is down significantly, many of those children remain in government care, just under a different department, the Department of Health and Human Services. And in fact, Representative Henny Kuehler, who's a Democrat from Texas, is accusing the Biden administration of playing what he calls, quote, a shell game with unaccompanied migrant children to mislead the public. His quote is, what they're doing now is they're moving the kids from the Border Patrol tents over to next door to the HHS facility. With all due respect, it's all been a shell game. End quote. Shuler has been one of Biden's most vocal critics during the border crisis. He represents a congressional district on the U.S.-Mexico border, so he really understands the realities of the border crisis and what's going on. He has said that the Biden administration's policies and his promises to reverse former President Donald Trump's deterrent policies have contributed to the border crisis. Well, Big surprise there. Is there anything else? Mark Morgan, who's a former acting CBP commissioner, reacted to April's numbers by claiming the message from Biden remains the same. Quote, the message is clear. America's borders are open. If you make it to the border as an unaccompanied minor or as a part of a family unit, you will likely be released into the interior. Once that happens, the Biden administration will do nothing to remove you, as the plummeting deportation numbers from ICE make clear. In fact, the Biden administration will push to give you the greatest reward of all, American citizenship via amnesty, in response to your lawbreaking. And of course, neither Biden nor Vice President Kamala Harris have visited the border during this migrant crisis. So that's an update on what's going on at the southern border. And then something that directly impacted the East Coast here in our state of South Carolina. On Sunday, the U.S. Department of Transportation announced a regional emergency declaration in response to the cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline, which the FBI confirmed the next day was a ransomware attack carried out by criminals belonging to the group known as Dark Side. And I think I've been hearing rumors in the last day or two that they ended up having to pay out roughly $5 million to this cyber attack, to this group, to get them to, I guess, leave or release what they had put under attack. Then on Tuesday, Governor Roy Cooper of North Carolina, Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, and Governor Ralph Northam of Virginia all declared states of emergency as long lines at pumps and rising gas prices hit their states amid shortages and runs on fueling stations. By Wednesday evening, Colonial Pipeline announced it had restored its operations. So here in South Carolina, there was a lot of panic Monday, Tuesday. But again, by Wednesday evening, Colonial Pipeline had announced that it had restored its operations. It would probably take a couple of days for everything to kind of catch up. And really, honestly, there should have never been the level of panic here on the southeast that there was, because there is so much oil, and we have so much oil in reserve that we would have been fine for a little while. And what we ended up actually creating our own crisis because of the panic, the long lines. You know, you couldn't go anywhere earlier this week without seeing long lines at the gas stations as people were just filling anything and everything that they could with gasoline. They were out there with every gas container that they owned, trying to get as much gas as possible. And it was, in my opinion, fairly irresponsible for some of the media, their reaction to this that really spurred on the panic, and then really some of these governors that declared a state of emergency. But we all know that, you know, they like to declare these states of emergencies because it gives them more control. So, this was a story out of Minnesota that I really wanted to get into, and it's a Minnesota Black School Choice Movement. And I really like it because I want to get the word out about what they're doing as an organization. And they have really just kind of blasted the notion of the United States as being racist, as wholly, I mean, they've just blown it out of the water and said that is wholly false. So what are the details? Well, the movement, which is Take Charge Minnesota, that's the title of it, is a school choice movement founded in the Black community, and it vows to tackle the idea of systemic racism. The notion of systemic racism, according to the organization, is, quote, structured to undermine the lives of Black Americans, end quote. And according to the organization's website, Kendall Qualls, who's a former U.S. Army officer and outspoken Republican, is leading the movement, which intends to counter that narrative and aims to, quote, inspire and educate the Black community and other minority groups in the Twin Cities to take charge of their own lives, end quote. He goes on to say, the organization, their website, goes on to say, we acknowledge that racist people exist in the country, but explicitly reject the notion that the United States of America is a racist country. This is a subtle but significant difference. We also denounce the idea that the country is guilty of systemic racism, white privilege, and abhor the concept of identity politics and the promotion of victimhood in minority communities. End quote. The group's mission is to inspire and educate Black and other minority communities of their full rights and privileges as Americans, greatness to them by the Constitution. The group also insists that the way to do this is through quality education, which the group calls the gateway to prosperity. They continue to say that we desire to inspire them to take charge of their own lives, the lives of their children, and not to rely on government and politicians for redemption and prosperity. We do not apologize for embracing America or its history. We believe that a well-grounded knowledge of American and world history strengthens our diverse country. What great messaging that they're sending out, that they're standing up and saying, and I've been saying this for a while, particularly on Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah when I was there. Look, it has to, the messengers have to come from their own community. You know, one of the things that we've learned in recent decades when it comes to evangelism as believers is that the best thing is for us to go to a country, go to an ethnic group, and make it, you know, evangelize, make a disciple, and then send that disciple back into that community. So that they would be able to, because there is no language barrier, there's no cultural barrier, there's none of these unnecessary walls between them and that people group. And that in the United States, we're such a diverse country. We have so many different people here of ethnicities and skin color and language and culture. And I've been saying for a while that it's going to take people of their own culture to go in, that you and I, as a middle-class, white, Christian American, it's harder for us to go into some of these communities that they do not relate to us, they have a hard time connecting with us, they don't feel like we understand and can connect with them. It's harder for us to do that. Not impossible, but it's harder. And so it's imperative that people who are able to understand, and I think, in my opinion, it's folks like Larry Elder, Candace Owens, Shelby Steele, Thomas Sowell, Clarence Thomas, folks who are able to, when we're talking specifically about this group of people, when you're talking about African Americans here in the United States, it has to be groups, it has to be people from that group who can go in and shine a light and say, and minister to them. Which is why it so excites me that you've got organizations like Blexit that Candace Owens has started, I think, in tandem with, his name just escaped me. He's a police officer, Brandon Tatum. Brandon Tatum's a part of it. There's a couple of others. And then this ministry, which is basically has a lot of the same messaging. And it's essentially they're going to their own communities. And they're trying to expose, bring the light of truth about these things. And of course, the most important thing that we can share with one another as believers is the gospel message of Jesus Christ. And so I don't really know. I haven't picked up if that's a part of what they're trying to do. I don't think so. I think it really is focusing in on the issue of systemic racism and trying to expose that for the lie that it is and trying to help the African-American community to combat the lies that they're told by the media, by a lot of folks in the education systems where they're at and from their culture, and to combat all of those lies in about systemic racism and about the origins of the United States and help African-Americans to embrace America and American greatness and what America can do for them and the how America has empower them to pull themselves up and make a better future for themselves and their children and their grandchildren. And of course, while I would love for this organization to also be sharing the message of Jesus Christ, this is I haven't picked up that that's what they're doing, but this is also a really great, I don't really know if ministry is the right word, but what they're trying to do is really powerful, and it's imperative because, as I said, it has to be folks from their own community because then they don't have the other barriers that I would have if I were to try to go in and connect with folks in these communities who feel like I have no idea what they go through in the battles that they have to face every day. And so I think it's a good thing for you and I, if you're not in that group, to try to support them as much as you can. And that's why I wanted to get the word out. Qualls, this gentleman that I mentioned already, he ran against incumbent Democrat Representative Dean Phillips in Minnesota's 3rd District in November, but he did lose, and he founded Take Charge Minnesota 2 months later. And he basically said, hey, look, I want to serve my community somehow. If I can't go and serve as a representative, then we're going to do this. And so he started the Take Charge Minnesota organization. And of course, they made headlines over the weekend, and that's kind of how it came to my attention, because they had an ad that ran for Mother's Day, and it read, "For many of you, it's a happy Mother's Day, but for us, it is not, because our children are being held in bondage. It is the bondage in Minneapolis public schools that, for 5 consecutive years, rank at the bottom of the country in test scores and graduation rates for students of color. Black children from Mississippi rank higher than Minnesota. We want a Mother's Day gift of freedom. Freedom of choice. Freedom as mothers, grandmothers, sisters, and aunts to choose the right school for the children in our families. Help us start a new life for them by supporting school choice." That's a powerful ad, especially on Mother's Day, because mothers want their children to do well. They want to empower their children with education and help them do better themselves, whatever that may look like. And so then on Monday, the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder reported that K-12 enrollment in Minneapolis and St. Paul charter schools has grown exponentially from 1,791 in 2001 to 11,624 in 2019 in Minneapolis, and 2,993 in 2001 to 12,432 in 2019 in St. Paul. So these charter schools that are giving more school choice are growing exponentially, as I said. They're also growing here in South Carolina. I know there's multiple ones. When we lived in Greenville, there was one that was really taking off and growing that had been a new, kind of a new school development in that area in Greenville. My husband worked there for a little while. And then here in Spartanburg, we've got at least one that's coming to mind right now, and it's doing very well. And parents want school choice. And I think it's really exciting for there to be an organization. So if you're in Minnesota, this is a really great organization that you could maybe partner with in some way to help bring school choice, and specifically for African-American students who are really being pressed down and held back by some of the school districts that they're in. So the last thing that I want to talk about is actually about the School of the Ozarks. I don't remember. It's been a while. It's the College of the Ozarks, actually. And I got to get the exact... Yeah, College of the Ozarks. It's a Christian school. They've got about 1,500 students, and they have filed a lawsuit against the Biden administration. They filed it in April after the Department of Housing and Urban Development issued a directive that required colleges and universities to open dorm rooms and other sex-specific spaces to individuals of the opposite sex. So, a couple of things about this. First of all, this is a direct violation of religious liberty, in my opinion. And I'll get to why that is in a minute. But the other thing I want to say about this is that when the whole bathroom debate kind of took place a couple of years ago, there was a specific situation that came up with a college campus, and it morphed into a conversation with this college campus, and they were pushing back for the same reasons. And I forget what the exact scenario was, but I remember diving in and doing some research on the topic. And I realized that we as Christian parents, in my opinion, lost this debate a long time ago, specifically when it comes to college campuses. And here's why. Because ever since the 1970s, a growing number of college campus dorm rooms have been co-ed. Until now, over 90% of college campuses have at least one co-ed dorm. Okay? Now, co-ed dorms, it may be that it's for married couples, but a lot of them are for, hey, if you coming in and you want to live with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, just sign up, let us know. We'll put you in this dorm over here and you can stay there, live there with them. The other thing is there are college dorms all across the country where you have men and women who freely go through one or the other. There's no restrictions whatsoever on visiting hours, on who can visit, on where they can go within the facility. It's kind of a free-for-all, basically. And over 90% of colleges in the United States have this kind of liberties on their college campuses. The reason that I believe this is a religious liberty issue in one aspect is the fact that because you have that on these other college campuses, on college campuses, secular college campuses, I'll say, it specifically targets Christian colleges because by and large, they're the only ones in the country who do not have co-ed housing and dorms for their students unless students are married. And usually it's not really a dorm that they have. It's a house or a housing complex attached to the school, attached to the university. So it's not typically the same kind of setup. And so when they say all colleges, well, really, the public universities, all of the secular schools, what do they care? They already are allowing students to live together, to go in and out of one another's dorms. And even if you're not officially on paper as saying, hey, we're living together in such and such a dorm as boyfriend and girlfriend, there's nothing to stop them from essentially living together if they wanted to. Now, it can get complicated because you've got a roommate oftentimes, but not always. And sometimes you have your own room with the roommate, depending on the setup of the dorm room. So when they allow this, or that when they demand this, it specifically targets the universities and the colleges in the United States who have drawn a line in the sand and said, we are not allowing there to be co-ed dorms. And I mean, when I was in college, I went to a school that was a Christian university, and we did not have co-ed dorms. And as a matter of fact, we were not allowed in the dorms of the opposite gender ever. There was two times a year, and one of them was there was Halloween, because kids from the community would come into the dorms and would trick-or-treat. And we would, you know, the students would escort the students from one dorm to the next, and so all of the dorms were open for that event. And that was pretty much it. And so there was a sidewalk on the outside of all of the dorms that everybody knew. If you were the opposite gender, you didn't go in the building. Now, of course, I think, you know, when you're moving in and all of that, they guys and gals would help each other move in and out on move-in day and move out and that kind of thing. It wasn't crazy. But still, so when these rules come down, it doesn't affect the secular schools pretty much at all because, they're already letting guys and girls pretty much live together. So what do they care if just now there's a guy that says he's a woman? And of course, when you're looking at the College of the Ozarks, one of the questions I'm sure that they're raising is, well, how long does he have to have any kind of surgery, any kind of hormones? Can he just decide one day that he's going to be transgender and that's it? We have to abide by that? You know, what if you've got a student who's really angry at his girlfriend, or a girl that's really angry at her boyfriend, and they want to get them while they're vulnerable? I mean, and I know I'm like making a big scenario out of this, but have you been in college recently? These kids are petty and they're vicious. No offense. But it's not a stretch to believe that girls who have been falsely accusing guys of rape and sexual harassment in growing numbers would do something like this, where they say, well, I'm transgender, and they move in, and then what are you going to do? What's that guy going to do? What's that girl going to do? And here's the thing, though, that really, the information that you really, really need to know. So in October 15th of 2019, Harvard released the results of a survey intended to estimate the prevalence of sexual assault and other sexual misconduct among its undergraduate, graduate, and professional school students. The survey, they conducted it in the spring of 2019. It reached about 23,000 students. About 8,300 responded. And of course, the data which echoed those from 32 other private and public Association of American Universities, institutions that participated in that year's survey, shows that sexual assault and harassment are a serious problem. And it's essentially unchanged. The problem, the rate of sexual assaults, the prevalence of it is essentially unchanged in the last 4 to 5 years since the last time they had done a survey. But here's the thing that is important for us to know, that among undergraduates, college students, the vast majority of non-consensual sexual contact is student to student, and it takes place in on-campus housing. 79.4%. Roughly 80% of all non-consensual sexual contact happens in on-campus housing. In my personal opinion, that is a huge mark in the pros column for parents who are considering sending their children to college next year and are thinking about sending them to a Christian university. Send them to a university that's going to do everything they can to protect your child from non-consensual sexual contact with another student. The other thing that's important to know is that 75.6% of these instances involved alcohol. Another thing that the university that I attended restricted was alcohol consumption. They did not allow students to drink on campus. They didn't even really allow if you were drinking off campus. They didn't allow that either. Now, they had different policies. You know, there's a one strike, two strike kind of thing. Or they have that now, at least. I wasn't a drinker, so I don't even know what the rules were. But if you're a parent and you're concerned, you should be concerned, in my opinion. You should be concerned about what's happening on college campuses regarding sexual assault. And these college campuses, they don't want to talk about it. Because they know, if you go on, there's an article from Harvard Magazine 2019 written in October. The president responds and all these administrators respond, and their response is to, well, the best thing that we can do is awareness training and teach other students how to spot when sexual assault is happening or non-consensual sexual contact is being inflicted on somebody. And so their response is, the second step was to better train students in reporting things. None of it has anything to do with protecting students from it actually happening. The only universities out there that are able to put a damper on this thing actually happening and not just responding to it is the Christian universities who say males are not allowed in female dorms, females are not allowed in male dorms. End of sentence. And furthermore, no alcohol. Because a lot of stupid stuff happens when kids start consuming alcohol. And that's evidenced by this. 75.6% of non-consensual sexual contact between student to student involves alcohol. And 80% takes place in on-campus housing. And so when the Biden administration is trying to tell the College of the Ozarks and all of these other colleges that they have to throw out their rules regarding men and women living together or being allowed in one another's dorms, and they have to disregard all of those, it should be of grave concern to us because all of these other universities are having major issues with the fact that they don't have those policies. Now, I'm not saying that sexual assault cannot happen on a Christian campus. Of course it can, and I'm sure that it does. But the vast majority of it happens in on-campus housing. And when you remove that from the equation, and then on top of that, you remove alcohol from the equation, the instances are far lower because you've removed the vulnerable environment and you've removed the primary contingency or contributor to the instance, which is alcohol. And of course, like I said, so as parents, I think that we really lost this debate about guys and girls and transgender, because like I said, what does it matter now if he identifies as transgender or she identifies as transgender and moves in with your son, into your son's dorm? Or a guy identifies as transgender and moves into your daughter's dorm? Because a lot of these universities have been allowing it, and they allow free passage at any time under whatever circumstances. So I don't really understand what the big deal is now. Except for the Christian colleges who have indeed drawn a line in the sand a long time ago. And now their beliefs are being violated by the Biden administration. So, again, that's the College of the Ozarks. There's an article, the Daily Signal has got more, an interview about this, and it's got some good information on there if you want more. And this survey, the sexual assault survey, which I think is imperative for parents to have in their back pocket. I just think it's things that we need to be aware of as we're helping our high school seniors make decisions. Again, that's at Harvard Magazine, and it's from 2019, from October was when it was written. And you can just Google that information, sexual assault survey, Harvard, and it should pop right up. Thanks. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.